We'll hear arguments first this morning in number 76, 5325, Browder against Illinois. Mr. Flaxman, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this case, as it was decided by the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit in an unpublished non-presidential opinion, involves several Fourth Amendment questions, each arising out of the warrantless arrest one evening of the four teenage black males found one night in the Browder dwelling in Chicago, Illinois. The director of the Illinois Department of Corrections, the respondent in this court, asked this court to resolve the Fourth Amendment questions on the basis of evidence received by the district court at a hearing on an untimely motion to reconsider. This is precisely what the Court of Appeals did. It relied on that testimony, it resolved disputed questions of fact in the first instance, and it reversed the decision of the district court. The first question which the court could resolve in this case, and which could indeed be dispositive of all the other issues presented, is whether the Court of Appeals was correct in relying on the testimony which had been heard by the district judge that untimely motion to reconsider. It's our position that the district court lacked jurisdiction to entertain that untimely motion to reconsider, and that the Court of Appeals lacked jurisdiction to consider the appeal from that untimely motion to reconsider, and that what the Court of Appeals should have done would have been to dismiss this appeal.
Well, if we reach that and decide it, we need not decide any other questions, isn't that so?
That's correct. The other question which the Court could also resolve is whether it's appropriate for a Court of Appeals to rely on an unpublished opinion rule and to a priori deprive its decision of precedent. It's our position that the use of that rule is interrelated with the disposition in this case, and that question could also be considered by the Court. But the only issue which the Court need decide in order to grant Mr. Browder the primary relief which he desires is to find that the Court of Appeals lacked jurisdiction to review the decision of a district court, and that the district court's order granting Mr. Browder's application for writ of habeas corpus should be reinstated and Mr. Browder re-enlarged from custody. The time limits in which a motion to reconsider may be made have, for the last 30 years, been delimited by the 10 days of Civil Rule 59. The motion to reconsider in this case was made 28 days after entry of the final order and was untimely under Rule 59.
Mr. Flaxman, I suppose that's the argument, isn't it, as to what is the final order?
The final order is the order which disposes of the case, the order which leaves nothing to be done except to execute what the district judge...
Well, that has to be your position, but I suppose one could argue the January 26th order was the final order.
That argument could be made, but it would be contrary to the type of final order which is appropriate in habeas corpus cases, and which this court has been directing the lower courts to enter when an order less than unconditional release is appropriate. This goes back to, I think, Chessman versus Teets, where there was some problem in the way the state court record had been prepared. This court felt properly, I believe, that it would be improper to release Mr. Chessman because of this procedural error, which could be cured, and directed the district court to enter such orders as would be appropriate to allow the state a reasonable time to cure the error, failing which the prisoner would be released. That's what the district judge did in this case. He decided that the petition should be granted, and he told Illinois that they had 60 days to retry Mr. Browder, failing which the writ would be executed.
Your position is, in effect, that the judgment as to the invalidity of the state conviction was final, and the state was just given a couple alternatives as what to do in consequence of that determination.
That's correct. That's the appropriate kind of final order when an order less than outright release is appropriate. And the state could have retried Mr. Browder if it acted within that 60 days. Or if the state courts were too congested, I'm sure the warden could have come to the district judge and said, we need more time to retry him because there are delays in the state court. And the district judge, I think, would have extended that time. And they would have had an ample time to retry him if that's what they wished to do.
Of course, the district judge did stay the earlier order pending further hearing, didn't it, pending an evidentiary hearing.
That's correct. And I think that he erred in doing that, but whether he erred in doing that isn't really before this court because we didn't seek review at that stage. We objected to the district judge proceeding with the hearing, pointing out to him that the time in which he can alter or amend his earlier order had elapsed, but the district judge proceeded with the hearing and received evidence. The argument that's raised by the director as to why that order granting the petition wasn't the final order is the claim that that order left unanswered the question of whether or not an evidentiary hearing would be required. That's a difficult point to understand because it seems obvious that when the district judge said this petition should be granted on the state court record, he was making a decision that no hearing was required. And he was making a decision that the state should appeal his order, or the state should retry Mr. Browder, or the state should release him from custody. And what the state did, rather than to follow one of those three permissible alternatives, was to file an untimely motion to reconsider and ask the district judge to hear further evidence and re-adjudicate the lawfulness of the arrest. The district judge lacked jurisdiction to hold that hearing, and the Court of Appeals lacked jurisdiction to consider the appeal from
What
from
would
that.
Have happened if the state had made that motion one day after the original order was filed?
Then it would be timely under Rule 59. The time to appeal would be told.
Is there anything in this record to explain why they did not?
There's nothing in this record to explain why they did not. And there's never been any explanation by the state or by the director as to why they waited 28 days. This rule is not a novel rule. There's no explanation. The other fact about the untimeliness is that the district judge in this case did nothing to lull the director into failing to appeal within the 30 days of Rule 4 of the appellate rules. The motion was filed on the 28th day. Under local rules in the Northern District of Illinois, it could have been presented in open court for a ruling at that time, but instead it was filed and allowed to lay dormant on the district court's calendar. So there's a decision by the director to rely upon the presumed power of the district judge to reconsider a final order after more than 10 days have elapsed. The district judge lacked that power and should not have received evidence.
Mr. Flaxman, the respondent's brief places some weight on a decision of this court a couple years ago in the United States against Dieter, which involved a criminal prosecution rather than a civil one. And I don't know if you file a reply brief or not. How do you distinguish Dieter?
Well, Dieter is consistent with our position. Dieter and United States versus Hewley arose from cases under the criminal rules, where under Rule 4B of the appellate rules, there is no tolling rule on motions to reconsider. So that in criminal cases, when a motion to reconsider is filed by the government in the time in which an appeal could be perfected, the filing of that motion tolls the time to appeal. The same rule is inapplicable to cases where appealability is determined by Rule 4A. Dieter states the general rule, which is applicable, that only timely motions to reconsider stay the time to appeal. In Dieter, in a criminal case, a timely motion is one filed within the time in which a government can appeal. In a habeas corpus case, in a civil case, in any case where appealability or where the time to appeal is governed by Rule 4A, a timely motion to reconsider is one made within the 10-day period of Rule 59.
But is Dieter entirely dependent on provisions of the rules?
It's dependent upon the absence in Rule 4B of any provision, any rule or statute authorizing petitions for rehearing, as was United States versus Hewley. That's what differentiates this case from that case. The argument is also made that Rule 4A doesn't apply to habeas corpus cases. The contention is that the tolling rules of 4A are in direct contravention of the conformity clause of Civil Rule 81A2. But if we look at the predecessor of Civil Rule 81A2, that is former Civil Rule 81B, which was in existence when the time to appeal was set by the civil rules, we see that the tolling rules in the civil rules were expressly and fully applicable to habeas corpus proceedings. The other civil rules were applicable only insofar as habeas corpus practice had conformed to practice in civil cases, but the civil rules, when they govern appeals, were fully applicable to appeals in habeas corpus cases. So what we have is the applicability of the 10-day tolling time. And unless this court concludes that the order granting the petition and leaving nothing to be done but to appeal or to execute what the district court had finally determined was not the final order, then the conclusion we have is that the motion to reconsider was untimely and that the appeal from the denial of the untimely motion to reconsider did not vest the Court of Appeals with jurisdiction to review the merits of the district court's final order, that the Court of Appeals erred in reversing the district court's decision. Even if the Court of Appeals did have jurisdiction, and it's our position that it's clear it did not have jurisdiction, the Court of Appeals, as the respondent in this court, resolved the Fourth Amendment questions by making its own findings of fact, by reading the testimony heard by the district judge at the hearing on the motion to reconsider in the light most favorable to the warden, who was the losing party in the district court. The ordinary rule followed by courts of appeals is that factual questions which are in dispute, which were in dispute, are resolved on appeal in the light most favorable to support the judgment entered. If the Court of Appeals had followed that view, it would have decided the probable cause question, in this case, the way the district judge had decided on the state court record.
The district court's freedom to find facts is somewhat limited by the 66th Amendment to the Habeas Corpus Act, though, isn't it, if there has been a state court record made on the point?
That's correct. In this case, this is why we come under the exception to Stone versus Powell, the legality of the arrest, the questions relating to probable cause to arrest, weren't heard and decided in the state courts. There was no full and fair adjudication of this issue in the state courts.
Of course, Stone against Powell says if you had an opportunity to make the claim, it doesn't say there has to have been an adjudication.
That's correct. But when there hasn't been an adjudication, as in this case there hasn't been, I think Stone versus Powell says that there has to be a full and fair opportunity. And when the question hasn't been adjudicated, I think full and fair opportunity has to be read together with Wainwright versus Sykes to be that when the issue wasn't raised at trial, the rule that has to be applied by the state courts to determine if there was a full and fair opportunity would be to allow the prisoner to show cause for why it wasn't raised and prejudice resulting from the default of trial counsel. That's what the district judge did in this case. Before he adjudicated the Fourth Amendment questions, he decided whether or not the question had been waived by the failure of trial counsel to have raised it in the trial court. The director argued that this question should be resolved in the state court record in favor of a waiver under the precedent then extant in the Seventh Circuit. And the district judge considered that question and found that under that case, which adopted standards virtually identical to those adopted by this court in Wainwright versus Sykes, that the question had not been waived and should be considered in federal habeas corpus, as the court said in Henry versus Mississippi, when it made clear that the states can apply any procedural waiver rules that they feel are appropriate, but that if they nonetheless refuse to adjudicate a constitutional question, it's open to the federal courts to determine whether or not the procedural rules followed by the state courts measured up to federal standards.
But when Wainwright versus Sykes didn't deal with any Fourth Amendment problem, which Stone versus Powell did deal with, I would have read Stone versus Powell to preclude review on habeas corpus if there had been an opportunity to litigate the question without regard to the cause and prejudice requirements of Wainwright against Sykes in other types of claims.
Well, I would have read it exactly the same way. I think we have to read, or I read, Wainwright versus Sykes as defining what opportunity means. As defining
but not for Fourth Amendment purposes, well, for right of counsel types of claims.
Well, I think that's a narrow reading of Wainwright versus Sykes, that the case has to be read together with the issues decided in that case and with Stone to define what a full and fair opportunity is. In this case, as in Wainwright versus Sykes, he had an opportunity to raise the constitutional claim at trial. It wasn't raised. In this case, we didn't have any opportunity in the state courts to show that there was cause for why it wasn't raised and that we were prejudiced from it not being asserted. I think if those two cases are read together, we come out with this case not being controlled by either or with Fourth Amendment relief not being barred by either Stone or Wainwright. And if this court agrees that the Court of Appeals lacked jurisdiction, that is that the final order was entered on October 21st and that notice of appeal was untimely with that order, then, of course, there is no question about Stone and about Wainwright. This case would have reached a final judgment because the appeal wasn't taken, and there's been no contention that those cases should apply retroactively to cases where relief had been granted, which had reached a final judgment, where a prisoner had been enlarged or virtually enlarged. But as the Court of Appeals resolved the probable cause question, which is the way that the respondent will, I think, come before this Court and argue the probable cause question, the Court of Appeals believed that the police officers had reasonable grounds to suspect that the person who had committed a crime was one of two persons. And the Court of Appeals held that under those circumstances it was permissible for the police to enter a dwelling at night without a warrant and arrest both of these persons, even when the offense under investigation had taken place 2 days before.
What time did they enter the dwelling?
At 6 p.m.
And it was night.
Well, it was a January day, which I think we can acknowledge was nighttime in Chicago.
Are you placing any emphasis on that fact?
We are. The Fourth Amendment questions are threefold. Perhaps the first question is whether it was lawful for the search of the dwelling to be undertaken in the absence of exigent circumstances without a search warrant. The Court has considered that question and has refused to adjudicate or declined to reach
that. I suppose the opposition will take the position that there were exigent circumstances here. But in any event, are you relying on the fact that it was what you call night, even though in May it would be all right?
Well, it's our position it would have been irrelevant whether it was daytime or nighttime. But in this case, it was nighttime.
That's why I asked the question.
Well, in this case, it was nighttime. In the next case, when it was daytime, I think that question should be decided. But here we have the evil in its most obnoxious form, which is nighttime entries to a dwelling. And if that reserve question is to be decided.
Well, it's a little different than 3 a.m., isn't it?
Oh, it's different in degree, but it's still nighttime.
What about the consent factor?
The consent should have been raised by the director in the district court. The director had two opportunities to show that the arrest was lawful. The petition squarely put an issue, the illegality of the search based on the absence of a warrant. Mrs. Browder was in the district court. She testified. There was no attempt made by the director to show that there was consent.
Didn't the record show that she talked with him and told him that she thought one of them was guilty?
The record shows the police testified that she said that. The record also shows that she testified and denied having said that.
Did she deny having admitted it freely?
That she wasn't asked about that when she testified.
My question was, did she deny it?
Did she deny it? She wasn't asked to deny or to agree with it. She was asked what happened. She said the police came to the door. I asked them what they wanted. They said, we're here for your sons. If she had refused to allow the police entry, she probably, under Illinois law, would have been arrested for refusing to assist an officer in discharging his duties. Illinois has.
Did she tell him don't come in?
No, she didn't tell him don't come in. If she had told him don't come in, she could have been arrested.
I'm interested in the record.
Okay. Well, the record wasn't made on this point. I think it's clear that the duty of showing an exception to the warrant requirement is borne by the party who's trying to uphold the legality of the search.
What does the state court record show about the consent factor?
The state court record shows what I just answered to Mr. Justice Marshall.
It shows no claim of a forcible entry.
No, we're not claiming that the entry was forcible. We're claiming that.
It shows, on the contrary, that the police testimony was she consented to their entry and permitted them to enter the house.
Well, the consent.
That's not disputed.
The consent that's shown by the record is the same kind of consent or accession to official demands that has been rejected by the court as being a knowing and voluntary consent to entry. In this case, the police officers weren't knocking on doors asking questions. They spent the evening getting together to go out to the Browder household to arrest some people. It's difficult to see how these police officers would have taken no for an answer when they arrived at the Browder residence and said, we're here to look at your sons, Mrs. Browder. There were four officers who got together to go out to the Browder household to arrest the people there to find out which one would be identified. The police officers, before they went to the Browder household, knew, or so they claim, knew that they would have to arrest more than one person. And they knew that they would be making an arrest for investigation, an arrest to determine whom should be charged. That's the kind of powers which this court has been reluctant to allow police officers to exercise, consistent with the Fourth Amendment. The way we read Davis versus Mississippi is that whenever the police are engaging in a planned investigative series of arrests, the only way, the only conceivable way that that could be authorized would be if it had been previously authorized by a judicial officer under one of, as suggested, or as the American Law Institute, for example, has read Davis and has suggested a model statute allowing limited detentions. In this case, the police decided or suspected that the person they were seeking might be one of the persons in that room, in that dwelling, and they went and seized all of them. There was ample opportunity to get a warrant. They knew they'd be seeking, they would be seizing more than one person. And that power, the power to arrest, to clear up an investigation, is a power which strikes at the...
Well, do you concede that if the police had reasonable grounds to believe that one of the four was guilty of this rape, that that would have given probable cause for them to arrest all four of them?
No, I would not concede.
Then what do you mean there was ample opportunity to get a warrant?
Well, what I mean is that everything the police knew on January 29th, when they went to the Browder household, they knew, and they knew 2 days before when the rape was reported. They knew, if they did know that the offender saw it was a teenager named Browder who lived in that block, they knew that the day right after the rape. Mm-hmm. And they waited 2 days before deciding to act on that. They could have done further investigation in those 2 days. They could have shown photographs to the rape victim. They could have gone to a prosecutor and confronted him with their problems of what should we do? We think it's one of several people. Should we go arrest them all? Should we get a warrant? Should this be turned over to the grand jury to summon these people down and have the rape victim look at it? They didn't do any of those things. They had ample time to do something other than to get together one evening and go out and arrest everybody there. So we don't concede that under those circumstances it's reasonable, it's lawful for the police to make a warrantless arrest of four people in the expectation or in the hope that one of them would be identified.
There were two teenagers at that address named Browder, weren't there?
There were two teenagers who said their name was Browder. There were two other teenagers who said their names weren't Browder, but the police may have suspected that they were lying. They were there to arrest a teenage Browder, like 16, 17, 18, 19.
And there were, in fact, two of them.
There were two who said they were Browder. That's correct.
Well, is there any question about their being Browders when you say they said they were Browders?
Well, they admitted to being Browders. There were two other teenagers said they weren't, that their name wasn't Browder, but the police officers didn't believe the two Browders and they said they didn't commit the rape, and they very well might not have believed the two other teenagers and they said our last name isn't Browder.
Isn't it conceded there were two brothers by the name of Browder?
It is conceded.
Who were picked up among the four?
That's correct.
And but then let me ask another question. Suppose that your client, Ben Earl Browder, were the only one there. Would you be making the same argument?
Well, I would make the same argument in addition to others. Because at the time, what we have to do is look at what the police knew at the time they entered the Browder residence to make the arrest. And if they had gone to a...
Would you answer the question? Would you be making the same argument?
I would be arguing that they lacked sufficient probable cause to arrest anyone based on what they knew. They had enough information to get a general warrant to search the 4,000 block of Monroe Street. They didn't know that this Browder family was the only Browder family who lived in this block. They made no attempt to determine if there were other teenage Browders. If, for example, there had been three Browder families, each with five teenage sons, this quantum information would have allowed the arrest of 15 people. The police simply didn't do enough in this case to narrow the focus to any identifiable person. The only warrant they could have gotten, the only arrest warrant they could have gotten, would have been a general warrant. That simply is not enough.
If the victim says, the person who committed the crime against me, his name is Browder, and he lives at a particular number on a particular street, would that be sufficient to go and arrest him?
That would be sufficient to go and arrest him.
So the only difference is they didn't give him the specific number.
Well, that's the first difference.
Is that right?
Is
that right?
That's the first difference. That what you're saying is correct. There's another distinction in that once the police got there, they found there were several people who matched that description.
No, my point was, but they could have arrested a Browder.
They would have had probable cause to go out and arrest a Browder. Once they found
they did arrest two Browders.
That's correct.
So what's wrong with it?
Once they found that there was more than one person who matched that description who lived at that address.
So if the man says that the guy that killed me, his name is Jones, and he lives at 213 M Street. And you go to 213 M Street, you find two people named Jones. You can't do anything.
Well, I'm not saying you can't do anything. What you can't do is arrest both of them to find out which one is
going
to do it.
What could you do in that situation?
Well, I think you first have to
find two people who say, my name is Jones.
police first have to make a determination, is anything going to happen if we don't act promptly? If they believe that both people are going to flee, then we have a different situation than what we have here. Here, we have the police calling ahead, finding out there are two people.
What could they do when two people say, my name is Jones?
Well, they have to make that first decision. Are they both going to flee if we don't do anything?
Well, assume it both ways.
Well, if they make the determination nothing's going to happen if we don't do anything, that both of these people are upstanding members of the community, they're not going to leave, then the police can't arrest them.
I didn't say nothing about upstanding members of the community. How do you know whether the man's going to flee or not?
I think that depends.
I assume if you come and say you're looking for a man named Jones who committed murder so that you can arrest him and convict him, that chances are he might leave.
Well,
which one of them would you arrest?
Under those circumstances.
Which one would you arrest?
In that hypothetical, I think the police could arrest both.
Okay.
The problem would be the search warrant question. Would it be reasonable to enter? Would it be lawful to enter a dwelling to arrest both of them? And they would still, we argue, need a warrant to
enter. In line of our cases, if he came to the doorway and they saw him, could they arrest him?
If they had probable cause to arrest.
If he came to the doorway, could they have arrested him?
If this court has held that the warrant is needed in that situation, the answer would be yes.
So they could arrest both of them?
If they were both in a public place and they both...
No. In the doorway of their own home.
If they were in the doorway, yes.
And these men were inside the room.
That's our argument. The warrant is needed to enter. If I may, I'd like to...
Very well, Mr. Flaxman. Mr. McCuskey.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I would like to briefly address the issue of the arrest, the probable cause for the arrest, and the nature of the entry. I'll keep my remarks very limited in this regard. It's important to keep in mind exactly what the police knew when they went to the Browder residence. On January 29th, they found out from the victim of the rape that her assailant was the brother of a person the victim went to school with. She knew that he was dark-complected, male Negro in his late teens, approximately 17 years of age. His last name was Browder, and he lived in the 4000 West block of West Monroe. She had narrowed it down to one block. This information was received on January 29th by a homicide investigator, Stan Thomas. It was not until the 31st of January, 2 days later, that Mr. Thomas conveyed this information to the juvenile authorities, who then went out and arrested. On January 31st, the juvenile officers received the information about 4:30 in the afternoon and had made the arrest by 6 at night. In that intervening time, they had located a Browder family on the block. They had located a juvenile record on one Tyrone Browder who lived at 4053 West Monroe. They had personally interviewed the victim of the rape themselves to verify the information that Mr. Stan Thomas gave them. They also called for a backup squad. 6 o'clock, they proceeded to the house. One other thing I forgot that's very important. Before they went to the house, the juvenile officer who was heading the investigation called the Browder residence and talked with the mother of Tyrone and Ben Earl Browder. He asked her if the sons were home, and she said yes, and he said, would you mind keeping them there until we get there? The police then got in their car and went over to the Browder's residence. In this time, Mrs. Browder had an opportunity to think over what she wanted to do when the police came there, if she wanted to change her mind since the phone conversation. The police arrived, knocked on the door. Mrs. Browder opened the door, and the testimony of the police officers invited them in. They went in. No search was conducted. The arrest was made. Miranda warnings were given, and the four gentlemen were taken to the police station. Now,
I take it you're conceding that the four were arrested at that time.
Your Honor, I believe the real explanation, I am not hesitant to concede that for the purposes of argument, the four were arrested. But I think what really happened in that context, and the juvenile officer who was in charge of the investigation so testified, they went to the house. They knew two Browders would be there, and they arrested both Browders because they both fit the description. There were two other young teenage black males there. The police knew that there was a second assailant. Sharon Alexander was raped by a man named Browder, but there was also another assailant with Browder at the time who also raped her. And so Mr. Conroy testified that he thought that maybe one of the other two could have been the second assailant. And that's why he asked the other two if they would go along to the police station to stand in the lineup. Mr. Conroy testified they volunteered to go with, and that was how the description of the events ended. Once at the police station, arrest slips were filled out for all four youths. So I think that they were arrested at any event, arrested at the police station when the arrest slips were filled out. I do not believe Mr. Conroy thought that he was arresting them at the time at the house, but I don't think it's very important. I think the important point there is, notwithstanding what Mr. Flaxman said, they weren't arresting all four because they thought one of the four was a Browder. They knew who the two Browders were. Mother introduced the police officers to the two Browders. It was the other person, the second assailant, they thought might be there. We argue in our brief that there was probable cause, like the Seventh Circuit held, and that the warrant was not necessary for the entry because the entry was consented to, and even if not consented to, was acknowledged by Mrs. Browder. We also argue that, in any event, a warrant is not necessary to enter a private dwelling to effectuate an arrest, and I would like to get back to that in a little bit if I could. I do feel compelled first, though, to address just very briefly Mr. Flaxman's initial argument, and that was that the Court of Appeals never had jurisdiction to even consider this case. There is dispute as to what was the final order, but right now I don't want to concede, but I'm willing to assume October 21st, 1975 was a final order. That order was a minute order and a memorandum opinion that was filed after respondent filed a motion to dismiss. The petition was filed, a motion to dismiss was filed by the respondent, and then later the district court granted the writ and impliedly denied the motion to dismiss, although that was never specifically stated. 28 days after the writ was issued with a stay of 60 days to retry the petitioner, the respondent filed a motion that was entitled Motion for an Evidentiary Hearing. It was respondent's position.
Is there anything in the record to show why it took you 28 days to find out what the law was?
There is nothing in the record with the exception of one statement in the motion for an evidentiary hearing that said that upon investigation, the respondent feels that one may reasonably conclude that there was probable cause. It's sort of an innocuous statement, but what the purpose of the statement was that this case was an old case.
There were newly discovered evidence?
I suppose you could phrase it that way, Your Honor.
Well, what was the newly discovered evidence? What the law was?
No, Your Honor. It was not what the law was.
Well, why wasn't it?
The problem that the respondent faced was to find out if there were, in fact, facts to present to the district court that there were arrests.
And the facts were what you presented, your witnesses.
That's right.
That were in your control.
Well.
And that's newly discovered evidence.
Your Honor.
How can you newly discover your own evidence?
The respondent, in this case, the director, the warden, the director of Illinois Department of Correction, nor his attorney, the attorney general, had any idea on whether or not there really were other facts presented in the record to establish probable cause. It had never been litigated. I certainly...
Well, didn't they litigate originally?
No.
Well, who represented the state in the habeas corpus here?
The Attorney General of the State of Illinois.
Well, that's who I thought represented. Well, was he incompetent?
I hope not, Your Honor.
Well, why didn't he put this in then?
Because he did not know that those facts existed.
Because he didn't know the law.
Because he did not know that Ms. Sharon Alexander gave a description of the police officers.
He did well, didn't not know. He have the facts?
He didn't have the facts. They were never litigated.
Didn't he interview the police officers?
Not just merely to file a motion
well,
to dismiss.
Well, do we have to change the rule to take care of somebody that don't know how to try a lawsuit?
No, I don't think the rule should be changed in that regard, Your Honor.
But you have no explanation for waiting 28 days to file a motion which should have been filed immediately.
I have an explanation, Your Honor.
And I'm waiting for it.
The Attorney General's office, as in all habeas habeas corpus cases receives a copy of the petition for writ of habeas corpus. The attorney assigned to the case reviews the petition. If he thinks a motion to dismiss would be in order, he writes a motion to dismiss. Basically, assuming what petitioner says is true, he hasn't stated a claim, files that without any factual investigation because none's necessary for a motion to dismiss. The motion to dismiss is ruled on. If it's denied, usually the district court judge gives the respondent 10 days or 20 days to file an answer, a responsive pleading. In this case, no such opportunity was given. The motion to dismiss was, in effect, denied. The writ granted.
Did the state's lawyer ask for any time?
No, Your Honor.
Well, what are you complaining about on that point?
Well, my first point, Your Honor, is that the attorney general, the representative of the respondent, needed time to do a factual investigation of a case five years old.
You left out one very important point. The attorney general's office is very overworked. You left that one out.
Well, Your Honor, they were overworked when I was there, and they still are.
Yeah,
but I certainly do not rely on that fact whatsoever. The fact I rely on, and that it takes time to do a factual investigation of a case 5 years old. Some of the police officers are no longer with the force, and some could not even be located to testify at the hearing.
But the record was there.
The record, unfortunately, did not go into the circumstances around the arrest because the probable cause issue wasn't litigated.
But, Mr. McCoskey, could not the Attorney General, within the 10 days provided by Rule 59, have filed a motion to amend the order to give him time to conduct a factual investigation and file an answer?
That could have been done, Your Honor.
And that would have avoided the whole problem of timeliness of the appeal, wouldn't it?
Well, I don't think the issue would have probably still been raised.
If he'd filed a motion within the 10 days? See, the problem with your position, as I understand it, is that the 10-day requirement just becomes a nullity.
That's right, Your Honor. Our position is that in habeas cases, number one, the federal rules, civil rules of procedure do not apply across the board. And it's basically in the discretion of the trial judge whether to apply them or not.
Well, if that's true, is it significant that the motion was filed within 28 days rather than, say, 31 or 32 days?
Yes, Your Honor, because traditionally and by practice in the federal courts, a motion to reconsider is timely filed and filed within the 30-day period for appeal.
Well, that's under Rule 60B, isn't it?
That I'm talking about basically United States versus Dieter and United States versus Healy. That those cases held that a motion to reconsider traditionally in civil and criminal practice is timely filed and filed within 30 days.
Your pleading was not filed under Rule 60B.
No, you're not. It was not, Your Honor.
And even today, you don't claim that.
No, Your Honor.
It was authorized by Rule 60B.
It was filed under rights under the Habeas Corpus Act.
Well, don't you weaken your case by abandoning all reliance on 60B?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not saying that 60B could be applied here in our favor. I think it would be applicable, but we did not make that argument. And I cannot say that we made the argument. We did not.
I know you didn't. On the other hand, if this is jurisdictional, may this court make it for you?
Well, Your Honor, I think if the respondent has left out an argument that clearly settles the issue, that the court would probably, or should probably, if I can be so bold, use the argument that the respondent did not raise. If, in fact, law and justice required, as the Habeas Corpus Act requires these petitions to be disposed in accordance with.
If you don't rely on Rule 60B, will you state as shortly as you can how you avoid the 10-day requirement of Rule 59?
Well, Rule 59 talks about a motion for a new trial. We never had a trial.
Well, or a motion to alter or amend the judgment.
Okay. Our basic argument is the federal rules of civil procedure can be applied by a district judge when he feels appropriate, when they're in line with disposing of a petition as law and justice requires.
That is in a habeas corpus procedure.
Right,
yeah,
correct.
Basic argument is that the federal rules of civil procedure do not all literally apply.
That's right.
Inexorably apply to a habeas corpus proceeding. Is that it?
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's supported by the new rules governing the habeas procedures and has always been in effect exercised by the courts.
And what's the test for knowing whether or not a particular rule of civil procedure applies in a habeas corpus petition?
It is in the district court's discretion. If he feels that a rule is applicable, then he can apply that. If he does not abuse his discretion, it cannot be disturbed. It's for him to determine what rules are appropriate to be applied.
Well, then you never know when anything's appealable. The whole purpose of the rules of civil procedure is to fix deadlines and let people know when a case is over, when it's finally at rest, if no notice of appeal has been filed. Your system would just leave the whole thing up in the air, wouldn't it?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so. When an order was entered that disposed of the case, granted relief to one party or the other, then that order would be appealable for a period of up to 30 days. There's no problem with that.
So then, if the petitioner loses for failure to present evidence, he could, 28 days later, come in and say, I've got evidence.
If I understand you correctly, Your Honor, yes.
He could. Then could he come in after that another 30 days? When would your time limit take place?
Your Honor, I think...
Surely you agree sometime it's got to end.
Certainly, Your Honor.
When?
I think that it would be in the same way that United States versus Dieter or U.S. versus Healy was handled. You have one motion to reconsider. It's been allowed traditionally and by practice. And when you have that one motion, however it's disposed of, you have 30 days from that time to appeal.
And that would apply to all the judges in that circuit? And would it apply to the next circuit? Would you leave this up to each court? Would you leave this up to each judge?
Leave what up to each judge, Your Honor? I'm sorry.
As to when or not he's going to ignore the 10-day rule.
That's right, Your Honor.
It would be leave it up to each judge.
It would be in their
discretion.
Well,
why not do away with the 10-day rule?
Well, I do not think that the 10-day rule should be applicable to habeas cases because of their unique nature. There may be some circumstances when they are. The rule that has traditionally been followed in practice in civil and criminal cases throughout the country in federal courts. Civil and criminal cases. United States versus Healy rule. You have 30 days to file a motion to reconsider and 30 days from the date of the disposition of that motion to appeal.
So the 10-day rule is up.
That's right, Your Honor. I think that...
Just a mistake?
It was a mistake? I don't think it was a mistake. I think it has a place... You're talking about normal civil suits. I think also that a district court judge could apply it if he wanted, if he thought it was appropriate. But I think if he does not apply it, he has that right. And only if he abuses his discretion in not applying it is there a problem. I think it's in the trial court's discretion, as other civil rules of federal procedure. The district judge chose not to apply it in this case. And I think his reasons for not applying were sound. The issue had never been litigated, and the state was making a claim that they had probable cause.
You wouldn't be making this argument except that this was a habeas corpus petition?
If it was, well, there may be other unique kinds of proceedings that should not be governed all the time by federal rules.
Well, would you say this kind of a petition would be out of time in a non-habeas corpus civil case?
A petition to reconsider?
Yes.
I think still... could be timely filed within 30 days in a normal civil suit under
so you
Dieter
really do
and Healy.
You really do say you should pay no attention to the rule.
Well, I say that you should pay no attention to it in a habeas case if the district court judge.
Well, I'm not asking you about a non-habeas case.
Okay, in a non-habeas case, I think the rules of federal procedure should apply strictly to those cases.
So this kind of a petition would be out of time in a regular. Civil case, a non-habeas corpus case. This motion to reconsider.
My reading of Healy...
Well, isn't there a yes or no to that or not?
Well, I am happy to say that this kind of motion would be out of time, but I think that opinion, my opinion there, might conflict with Healy.
Why? What makes you think so?
Because Healy and Dieter say...
Healy never said that petition for an out-of-time petition for reconsideration would extend the time for appeal.
If it does not...
And none of the cases in which it relied said that.
If it does not, Your Honor, then I'm mistaken, and I apologize. But that was my reading of the case, and also Dieter. I think both of those appeals were filed after 30 days of the original order.
But Dieter was a criminal case where you don't have the counterpart of Rule 59.
No, that's correct, Your Honor. But Dieter says that a petition for rehearing has been traditionally considered timely filed in civil and criminal cases. if within the 30 days. Dieter was not a civil case.
Did you read the cases that Healy cited for that proposition?
I do not know of any cases, Your Honor, civil cases, considering a motion to reconsider. I do not know of any. And that's why I'm saying I don't hesitate to say that the rules of civil procedure should apply strictly in normal civil cases.
Well, the lead case that Healy cited says in it that the filing of an untimely petition for rehearing does not extend the time for appeal.
What case was that, Your Honor?
That case is Bowman against La Perina. You ever read it?
No, Your Honor, I have not.
Well, Healy, the people who wrote Healy certainly read it.
And I apologize to the Court. I am not familiar with the case, Your Honor. I thought
the argument you were making at the outset is that for all practical purposes, a habeas corpus case is a criminal matter and should be viewed in the criminal context, just as Congress has viewed it for purposes of the Criminal Justice Act. And
aren't you glad to know that on the topic?
Do you have to go beyond that and try to give this unlimited discretion to each district judge to fix time limits at his own view?
No, Your Honor. There's no question that the habeas case underlying it is solely criminal issues, and it arises from a criminal case. I'm afraid that, being as direct as I can, I got into trouble with the civil, talking about normal civil cases. I am happy to say that without exception, the federal rules of civil procedure should apply in civil cases. I only mentioned it. I thought that might conflict with Dieter because of the word civil in there and criminal. I'm happy to withdraw that, and I think habeas cases are special.
But Mr. McCoskey, even if you treat it as a criminal case, it wouldn't solve your Healy and Dieter problem with, because there was no rule authorizing an appeal by the government or a delay in the time to appeal by the government, whereas there is a provision for some kind of a motion by a defendant that loses, isn't there, in a criminal case?
There is provision in a criminal case. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I did not...
Can a defendant in a criminal case after conviction move in the district court for a new trial?
Yes, he can.
Whereas the government cannot.
That's correct.
And isn't that the thing that was missing in the... It's not just a civil-criminal distinction, but it's also the fact that it was a party who had no right in the district court to get an extension of time for a new trial other than by an analogy to a petition for rehearing.
I think that's correct.
So that even if you treated this as a criminal case, you still have your 10-day problem. Because here there is a rule squarely in point that says within 10 days, the court has power to alter or amend the judgment.
I think that the basis of Dieter was that, based on tradition and history, I mean, besides tradition and history, that it was the most economical way to adjudicate the issues. And I think that same rationale applies here. To give a respondent 10 days to move for some kind of relief after his motion to dismiss has been denied and nothing else has been stated on the case, I think provides a burden on him that is very hard to comply with at any time when you're talking about habeas cases.
Well, you say after his motion to dismiss is denied, but actually the 10-day period contemplates the motion to be made after a trial also, which is a much more burdensome thing. You try a 6-month case and figure you've got to go in within 10 days and file a motion to alter or amend the judgment. And I think you've got a much bigger problem than you do in your typical ruling of law type of thing that you had here without any evidence taken.
When you go through a long trial, at least you know what the facts of the case were. When our motion to dismiss was denied here, we did not know what facts the police officers had in their possession in a case that was 5 years old, and we had literally tracked down people. It was not a matter of office work, going through a voluminous record, or checking your memory for what happened in the trial. In a case like you described, Your Honor, at least you know the facts. Here we did not have any idea what the facts were and had to scout them up.
How long before had this trial taken place, these events?
It was August of 1971.
And how long was the trial?
I believe that it was 3 days. I think it was 2 or 3 days.
And how long would it take you as a lawyer to go over a 3-day record?
It not very long, Your Honor.
It would be less than 10 days, wouldn't it?
The problem was,
it would be less than 10, wouldn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. The problem is that the record included absolutely nothing on the probable cause issue, and we had to go outside the record to locate witnesses around the city of Chicago. I would also like to mention, too, in passing on this, that if the civil rules of federal procedure do apply, then the rules were violated by the district court by ruling on the merits of the case with only our motion to dismiss pending. Certainly in any other kind of civil case where the federal rules of civil procedure apply, motion to dismiss, the case cannot be decided on the merits after with only a motion to dismiss pending. He did not consider it as a motion for summary judgment. He did not, the petitioner did not file a motion for summary judgment. Only thing that we had pending was a motion to dismiss where we admitted everything the petitioner said and said he did not state a claim. We had a right to a hearing if our motion to dismiss was denied. The trial judge did not give us that in compliance with the rules. He did not give us a chance to answer whatever the provision is, 10 or 15 or 20 days to file an answer.
But we that, too, is something you would ordinarily raise by appeal.
That's right, Your Honor. To raise that by appeal, though, would just to have expanded the litigation over years. We would have went up to the Seventh Circuit, asked for a hearing. They would have gave us a hearing, hopefully. We would have went back down to district court. District court would have found no probable cause. We would have been back up to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. They would have found probable cause if they stuck to their original decision, and it would have just taken a couple more years. It certainly saves a lot of time, and I think that was part of the reason in Dieter, to ask right there in the district court for the hearing, avoid one appeal. I would like to also speak briefly, if I might, concerning the Stone versus Powell issue and the Wainwright versus Sykes issue. It's our contention, basically, that the search and seizure issue, the Fourth Amendment claim, is not cognizable in a habeas case. And even if it is cognizable, the defendant has, or the petitioner has, in effect, waived his right to present that issue in a federal habeas corpus petition because he did not object to the entry of the evidence at the in the trial court on the basis of unlawful arrest. Stone versus Powell requires an opportunity. The state give an opportunity for a petitioner to raise a Fourth Amendment claim. The state of Illinois provides such a procedure. A motion to suppress evidence can be made before trial if the facts were not known at trial. This opportunity provided for in Illinois statutes safeguards the deterrent effect of the exclusionary rule, which was the main concern in Stone versus Powell. Simply put, as long as the police know that illegal seized evidence can be suppressed or will be suppressed by a state court, there is no incentive for them to disregard the Fourth Amendment. In fact, there is a deterrent because illegally seized evidence will not be allowed. The fact that the defendant in trial court and the petitioner here did not choose to challenge the evidence in the state court doesn't detract from the effectiveness of the Illinois procedures in deterring police conduct. It would only have an effect on the deterrence if we could assume that a police officer would think, well, I can seize this evidence illegally because the defendant's attorney probably won't raise the issue. I don't think that that can be a valid assumption. The state did nothing to interfere with the opportunity the petitioner had in state court to present his issue. There was an opportunity. Defendant did not take advantage of the opportunity, but it was there. And therefore, this purely Fourth Amendment claim is not cognizable. If it was cognizable, if it is cognizable, the defendant did not raise the issue in the trial court. He did not raise the arrest issue on a motion to suppress. He did raise the arrest issue at trial, using it to show that the police officers really didn't know who they were arresting, that there was no warrant, there were four arrested, investigation array, using it to show the jury that the police weren't sure who committed the crime, and therefore the jury should not be sure who committed the crime. Petitioner's trial counsel knew the factual basis for an arrest claim. He filed motions under the contemporaneous objection rule, so he was aware of that. In fact, his efforts helped secure the petitioner's acquittal on the armed robbery charge, although he was convicted of rape. There's no challenge that he was competent. Simply, the petitioner has not shown cause why his failure to object in trial court should be excused. Also important here is the reliability of the evidence. In-court identification was from an independent source, not the arrest. The district court and trial court held that. The confession was purely voluntary. It was a volunteered statement after two eyewitnesses identified the defendant in a lineup. He admitted to one, denied the other. called the police officers over to speak to him. No interrogation whatsoever. Each statement was only a couple minutes long. Miranda warnings were given three times. In short, it's our position, the issue is not cognizable. Secondly, Wainwright versus Sykes, application of that rule only leads to one result, that he waived the issue because there's no cause and there was no prejudice from the alleged constitutional violation. Thank you very much.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Flaxman?
Yes, Mr. Chief Justice.
If you should prevail on the jurisdictional issue, do you think we must reach the Rule 35 issue that you also raised?
No, I don't think the court must reach. Mr. Browder would be happy with reinstatement of the petition, of the writ granted by the district court. The primary argument that I've been listening to is that the state or the director didn't have time to get together its motion to reconsider within 28 days. The motion that was filed in opposition to the petition was not really a motion to dismiss. It was a motion for summary judgment. It was based on facts set out in the state court record that were before the district judge, and it relied on those facts. It was in our memorandum filed in support of the petition, we suggested that it would not be inappropriate if the district judge so desired to allow an evidentiary hearing for the director to show that there's probable cause to this arrest. If the director had come in within 10 days and said, Judge, you didn't hold an evidentiary hearing, you should have held one, even the petitioner thinks you should have held one, we probably would have been stopped to dispute that and a hearing would have been held. Rather than come in within 10 days, there's this 28-day delay.
What if the motion, instead of being denominated a motion to alter amend, had been denominated a motion for a new trial on the basis of newly discovered evidence under Rule 60, and the same time sequence had obtained?
Well, if it had been, regardless of how it was labeled, if the district judge construed it as a Rule 59 motion, it would have told the time to appeal. If it had been a Rule 60B motion, which could be filed any time after the notice of appeal should have been filed without tolling the time to appeal, then there would be the standard for review from the denial of that motion would be whether the district judge had abused his discretion in refusing to modify his earlier order. And there is no abuse of discretion here. Evidence before the district judge at the hearing of the motion to reconsider was contradictory.
But at least there the Court of Appeals would have had jurisdiction to entertain the appeal.
That's correct. That's exactly what we argued in the Court of Appeals, that this appeal should be viewed as an appeal from the denial of Rule 60B relief. The director conceded or represented and urged the Court of Appeals not to view it as a Rule 60B appeal and has urged this court not to do so. I think it would be inappropriate for this court to go back and reconstrue the case if it had been an appeal for denial of Rule 60B relief. Even if it had been, though, the result necessarily would have been that the district judge should have been affirmed if there were ample contradictions to support his refusal to modify his earlier order. The argument that Rule 59 does not apply to habeas corpus proceedings overlooks what I think Mr. Justice Rehnquist was getting at in his question as to how do we tell which civil rules apply. We can tell that when it's not explicitly said by looking at former practice and seeing if former practice in civil cases conformed to practice in habeas corpus cases. And indeed it did, as we make clear in the two cases that we cite in our brief in a footnote at page 21.
The time has expired, Mr. Flaxman. Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next.